Music City, Nashville, Tennessee.
Two guys fumbling their way through the music business so you don't have to. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino and the Music Row Show.
Turn your cell phone off, Scott.
Cell phone's off. Hello, friends. Welcome to the Music Row Show. My name is Scott.
And my name is Hino. Thanks so much for tuning in. We love it that you're here with us. This show is for all you songwriters and performers and just musicians out there who are just trying to figure stuff out here in Music City.
That's right. Now, remember, we don't have any answers.
Nah.
We don't know anything. We're out there slinging songs during the day just like you guys are. But we are able to find brilliant people, bring them into the studio, pick their brains, and give you the opportunity to join in the conversation as well.
Absolutely. You can do that by going to facebook.com/TheMusicRowShow, or you can also hit us up on Twitter at TheMusicRowShow, and we'll get your questions that way.
I got to get on the Facebook, don't I? So I can
the
be
Facebook.
Part of the
yes,
the Facebook.
Yes.
So I can be part of this conversation.
Yes.
And in case you haven't heard, Hino, Dish subscribers, you can now watch us on TV because Blue Highways TV is now on Dish.
What?
Yeah, it's a big deal.
No, that's true. You can watch us 4 times a week now on Channel 73 on Dish all over the U.S. So that's for the first time ever here in Nashville, which is pretty cool.
We've been on TV for 3.5 years, but finally in Nashville, you can watch us.
Finally in Nashville, yeah.
Well, we have a full show tonight. We have award-winning hit songwriter, Songwriter Hall of Fame inductee Tom Douglas here in the studio in Hour 1.
That is so true. And then we're going to be talking with hit recording artist John Barry in Hour 2.
Very, very nice. Well, let's get to it. Hino, do the honors, would you please?
Absolutely. Now, tonight we're welcoming hit songwriter and songwriter Hall of Famer, Tom Douglas, is here with us right now. Tom's got an amazing catalog of songs that includes songs like Run to You for Lady Antebellum, Love's the Only House and God's Will for Martina McBride, Southern Voice and a whole bunch of other songs for Tim McGraw, One Mississippi for Brett Eldridge, Raise 'Em Up for Keith Urban and Eric Church, and of course, who can forget the CMA and ACM Song of the Year for Miranda Lambert, The House That Built Me, one of my favorite songs ever, really. Tom also teaches lyric writing at Nashville's Belmont University. So all that put together, we're just thrilled to death to be able to say, Tom Douglas, welcome to the Music Row
Show. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Yay.
Happy to be here with you. Thanks.
All right.
Well, you have, you've always been kind of an inspiration for me watching your career path because I also moved here in my late 30s. It was, you know, that was, it's unusual. Normally people are coming here a lot younger.
Right.
Talk about deciding to give equal time to that other part of you.
Well, I mean, you know, starting kind of, I guess at the end, working backwards, I didn't get my first country song recorded till I was 41. So it is a circuitous route for really most people. You look at people that have, you know, great success. And the fact of the matter is, without fail, Nashville is a 10-year plan.
It's, right.
There's really no way to shortcut it or short circuit that, and I really don't know why. I think it just takes an inordinate amount of time to kind of figure the town out, figure yourself out, find your own voice. And so I had come here once in the early '80s and was here for 4 years, and then left never to return, and then came back 13 years later. So it's a, but you know, I really wouldn't trade it. Because all that life experience, I think, really helps me in the songs that I write.
Well, you were doing commercial real estate, right, when you decided to, okay, we're doing this.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had done real estate in Atlanta. Then I came to Nashville and did music for 4 years. And then I met my wife and thought I'd wasted 4 years of my life here in Nashville. Although I enjoyed it, it was just, you know, Nashville is really, I think, the loneliest place in the world if you're on the outside looking in, which is, I mean, I still feel that way most days on the outside looking in. But, and so really at age 31, I said, I want to start over. I want to forget music, forget songwriting. I'm going to get back in the real estate business. I got married, moved to Texas, and really tried to forget songs for a long time. But they really haunted me and finally chased me down. And so finally, after 8 or 9 years out there, I really kind of just regained my love for the gift of songwriting and quit trying to write songs that I thought were commercial or successful that people would like. I really just thought, you know, God has given me a gift to write songs. Why don't I just enjoy that?
And right.
Once I kind of did that, you know, some of the pieces started to fall into place.
Hmm. Nice. When did you first realize that you had a love for lyrics in particular, and how did you go about learning that craft on your own?
Well, I realized that, I think, early on. You know, you assume that everybody's thought process is like your thought process, even as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I just assumed everybody had words running through their mind, and I assumed that people saw life through pictures and short stories, you know, only to find out, you know, the older you get, that most people don't look at life like that.
Yeah.
But I mean, I remember really as a, you know, 12, 13, that I had a love for words, and had love for poetry, and had love for stories. And I got that from my father, who was an artist at heart. He sold steel for United States Steel for 45 years, but he passed down really the love of just songs to me. And so I think my appreciation for that was probably early on.
How did he do that? Just by having it around all the time?
You know, or? I mean, looking back, he you would, if we'd be watching TV and a song would come on, you know, most people would talk about the singer or maybe the musicians.
Right.
But I mean, my father really, he kind of deconstructed songs for me.
Really?
Really as a child. You know, he would just talk about, you know, that meaningful line or wonder what that means. And, you know, kind of slowly over time, I started not really listening to singers, not really listening to musicians or even the artists, but I was really listening to the song.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, I assumed everybody kind of looked at it like that. But
yeah.
But I was just always drawn, and I was, you know, more specifically, I was really drawn more to the words than I even was the melody.
Wow. So you were aware of songwriting as a profession pretty early on then?
Well, I was aware of it, but, you know, my parents both were children of the Depression. They were older when I was born. My father was born in 1911, and so my father and my mother, kind of the preeminent value in my household was really, I mean, music was loved, but it was an avocation. It was all about job security, and it was about getting a job and keeping a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to do that because my parents had sacrificed for me to go, you know, to private high school, and then I went to college, and I went to graduate school, so I had all this education. Finally, at age 27, I couldn't take it anymore, and I finally ran away from home at age 27 and came to Nashville for a four-year odyssey. But so, you know, I mean, for me, when I told my parents I was going to come to Nashville, I may as well have said, I'm going to go join, you know, a band of gypsies and go to Transylvania. I mean, it was radical, but I finally had to do it.
Wow. Well, talk about the importance, even though that first 4 years were quick, in and out, basically,
yeah.
Even then you were starting to build a network of peers. And, you know, when you first met Paul Worley, who was critical in your initial success, he was not Paul, the mega hit producer at the time. And I'm saying that for our listeners who think, I'm going to come to town and I'm going to get Paul Worley's attention.
Right.
So, you know, what was Paul doing when you guys met, and kind of talk about that?
Yeah. Well,
path.
That's a good point. Paul was, you know, he was a guitar player. He was like the A-list guitar player when I first met him, and he would do demos, and we kind of became friends that way. And I think your point is well taken, which is we assume that, you know, when you get here, what you really want is to get to the top producer or the top artist. But the truth is, what you want is to kind of find your peer group and grow up together within that peer group. And that's kind of what I did with Paul. He was always very kind to me and did like my songs. And it was really 10 years later that I reconnected with him at an Austin songwriting seminar. And I gave him a cassette of a couple of songs, which miraculously he listened to. And then by that time, he was kind of the head creative guy at Sony Publishing. He signed me to Sony Publishing So really, I mean, really God brought, you know, that back together, even though I assumed that that first 4 years were, you know, a mistake. The truth is, you know, if I hadn't gone those first 4 years, you know, I never would have been prepared and wouldn't have had those relationships.
Right.
10 years later.
So everything matters when you're starting out.
It everything matters. All the small things matter, and you know, honestly, the way that you treat people matters really more than the songs or more than anything else. It's music, just like everything else, is a people business.
Yeah.
And you know, you need to have those relationships,
sure,
and you need people to help you. And people have to kind of like you to help you. And Paul was, you know, has been always so helpful to me.
And importantly, you never know who that person's going to be.
You really don't.
The valet guy that you were
right,
just rude to, you know,
yes,
could be the label head 10
right,
years from now. You
well,
just never
that's
know.
Exactly right. That's a great lesson. You just, you know, it's a very difficult business, and you know, it's easy to kind of overlook people, but everybody matters. You
yeah,
know, there really is a, you know, you look at your life and you think it's all these broken pieces of glass, you know, when you're going through it, only to realize later, you know, it's a beautiful stained glass window, but you know, you can't really see that at the time.
Mm. You know how many of our listeners are writing that down?
Oh my gosh. That's
stained glass window.
Stained glass window. Stained glass window.
Well, I'm going to go work on my version of that here. We're going to take a quick break, but we're going to come back with a whole lot more of Tom Douglas in just a second. But we do want to remind you that this segment is brought to you by our good friends over at Toyota of Cool Springs.
That's absolutely right. And we love these guys. Both Hino and I drive Toyotas. Their motto is they want to give you an excellent deal and an excellent buying experience. And we love that they have a lifetime warranty with unlimited time and miles on every new car, a 3-day exchange policy, and they're just low key. They're friendly. You walk in there and you feel, you know,
relaxed.
You're not jumped on.
You're not getting pounced on the second you walk through the door. Ask for George. He's the owner. He's a great guy. He'll take good care of you. And you can find him on the web at toyotaofcoolsprings.com. We're going to be back with more of Tom Douglas here on the Music Row Show. All right, welcome back to the Music Row Show. Wow. That right there is the demo for I Run to You. That was a big hit for Lady Antebellum, and we are here with the writer of that song, or co-writer of that song, Tom Douglas, Hall of Fame songwriter. That's cool. I like that. That's much more ballady than the cut was.
Well, honestly, everything I write, everything I play, it sounds like that. I mean,
okay.
Really, every song, if you heard every demo, it would be like, wow. That sounds just like the other one. And I keep waiting for somebody to show up and say, you do realize you're writing the same song over and over. So maybe you guys can finally tell me that today.
But I wouldn't dream
never.
Of it.
I would
not dream of it. But I've heard you say that, though, that really a lot of your songs, even thematically, are kind of the same. The Prodigal Son, you know, you have a lot of the same
themes
according to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, honestly, it sounds like I'm making a joke, which it kind of is, but I have written honestly about the same character, the same protagonist from really my first breakthrough, I guess, mentally was Little Rock. So honestly, the character in Little Rock which was written in 1992, is really, in my mind, the same character that's in Raise 'Em Up. It's just, okay. It's the same guy. I know the character well, and he always, you know, he's broken, and he's in need of redemption. It's a very simple story.
Yeah.
The scenery changes, and some of the cast of characters change, but that one character doesn't change. I realized that maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago, it's almost like a movie, or it's like a novel, that these songs to me are more like short stories. And, he keeps getting into a problem, and then I have to resolve the problem, you know, within 3 minutes and 45 seconds. I don't know if other people do that, but I like the character.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
Except for now, 3:45 is probably now 2:40, like 2:30 yeah. now, right?
So I got to shorten his shorten his problems.
Well, we've had other writers on the show say that getting your first hit, or getting their first hit, was kind of easy compared to getting another one after that. To talk about that and how that was for you.
Well, I mean, you know, Little Rock was, I guess, 1994, and then
that was for Colin Ray,
that was
right?
Colin Ray, yeah. And yeah, I think it is. It's honestly, you know, the more that you think about hits, the more that I think about hits, and the more I think about really the song itself is almost self-defeating. I have found over time it's much better to, I mean, you obviously want to finish the song, and you have to love the song when you finish it, but as soon as the song is completed, you have to jettison the song and detach yourself from it.
You mean just forget about it?
Forget about it. The song, I mean, it sounds odd to say, for songwriters, it is not true for publishers, not true for artists, but I think for songwriters, it's odd to say, but I think the song in and of itself is the enemy. Because the more you think about the song, the less you're going to be able to throw yourself back into the process. For songwriters, I'll just speak for myself. It's got to be all about process. It's just, the last song, it really doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is the ability to get up and face the resistance tomorrow morning and write the next song. And I mean, you want it to be as great as it can possibly be, and you hope people like it. But the more that we think about things over which we have no control, it's just, they're landmines waiting for us to walk over. So.
And by that, I'm guessing you're referring to, you know, pitching it, getting it cut, and who heard it, and that kind of thing.
Even thinking about it, even wondering, is anybody going to like this, you know, which is very difficult, because when you write a song, you demo it, you turn it in to people, and the people that pitch your songs, or maybe it's just friends or family. But, I mean, in you, there's a part of you that obviously that hopes everybody loves it. But
you want that validation.
You want that validation, but that validation is an addiction, and you really have to, I think I have to really have to try to wean myself from that addiction. And, it's just, cause you're going to get stuck, and you're going to, you know, if so-and-so passes on the song, then you're going to be, you know, you're going to be stuck in this mire of self-doubt and self-analysis. And you're going to miss the next song if you get stuck there too quickly. So
as you're saying this, I think about some of the song contests that we've had here on the show where somebody sends a song, and then 2 days later they go, here, I added fiddle to it,
right.
And then a couple days later, I took the fiddle out and added bouzouki, and you end up with seven or eight versions of their same song, and none of it changed it, but they were so focused on that.
Yeah,
what you're saying, they, who knows what they're missing?
Well, I mean, believe me, I'm the chief culprit. So it's not like I'm saying all that to myself. I'm not. It's not like I'm saying I got it figured out.
Right.
I struggle with it. That I need validation. You know, my self-worth file is constantly shredded, so I need it constantly renewed, but it's not going to come from outside. It's got to come from just I just get to write another song, right. And that has to be enough.
But you have to think about it at least long enough to decide which one you're going to demo or that kind of thing, or do you leave that to other people to do?
No, I mean, I you do want to do that. You want to demo the song, and then you want to put it in capable hands. I mean, it's a real partnership. Some people are great at pitching their own songs. They can wear two hats and compartmentalize. I can't. I'm good at really one thing, and that's really the only thing I'm really good at is honestly writing lyrics. I mean, the rest of it, I'm a terrible musician. I'm not good at melody. I write the same melody over and over again. So I'm good at really one small thing, and if I stay doing that, you know, I'll be able to, you know, do it again tomorrow.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, talk about The House That Built Me. I read that took 6 to 7 years to write, and I was just kind of going through some things that you've said where you've said God is in the details, but your publisher kept saying this is too complicated. Yeah. This song is too complicated. So there's a fine line between God is in the detail and throwing too much in there. Talk about that.
The truth is, Stephen Sondheim said God is in the details. I should give him the proper attribution. Stephen Sondheim said about lyric writing, less is more, let content dictate form. God is in the details, all in the service of clarity, without which nothing else matters. So that's Stephen Sondheim, who I think is probably, you know, the greatest lyricist, maybe the greatest songwriter that's been on Broadway in the last 40 years. But, you know, details, I think, you know, it propels a story. It fills out the character. But in The House That Built Me, Alan Shamblin and I, believe it or not, were in Sundance in Utah we were going to perform a couple of shows out there. And Alan came into the restaurant early one morning and he said, I've been reading this article about how houses have memories. He said, what if this is verbatim from Alan. Alan said, what if there was a song that was not The House That We Built, but what if there was a song called The House That Built Me? And as soon as Alan said that, it was like red lights were flashing, sirens were going off. And I said, Alan, promise me you will not utter those words to anybody else until we get back to Nashville. We got to write that. And so we did, but it honestly did take 6 or 7 years. We had numerous revisions. You know, we'd work on it a couple of times a year, and each time we'd think we'd had it. But at the very end, once we did, we had too much information. So we had to take out some of the details and some of the information, just kind of get down to the salient points. And we also didn't have, if I can just come in, I swear I'll leave, won't take nothing but a memory.
Yeah.
Once we had that, we kind of had the song.
That's the story right
there.
Yeah. Wow.
I think of co-writes I've had with people that after 3 or 4 times, it's like, it's a good idea, but we're getting nowhere together on this.
And then you never touch it again.
And you never touch it again. So I'm just so fascinated by the fact that you guys kept at it.
You know, I mean, Alan is a, you know, Alan looks at it honestly like, you know, it's a very blue collar job, and you just kind of show up really with a lunch pail and you just go to work. And I mean, it's time is, you know, time helps with not many things, but time, I think time helps with wine and time helps with songs.
Okay.
I think, you know, you have a context about a song the longer that you live with it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we just love the idea. So, you know, we just kind of kept whittling away at it. And, you know, each time that we did 3 or 4 revisions, 3 or 4 demos, and each time we did it, we thought we had it every time. But
did it change melodically and structurally a lot, or was that part the same?
Not really. I mean, honestly, it just got simpler and simpler.
Okay.
And simpler. And then, you know, again, often the line that precedes the hook is more important, or is as important
right.
as the hook itself. And so once we kind of found that line, that set the hook up, and then the story kind of told itself.
Mm.
Wow.
That's pretty
interesting.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, you know what? I've got a question, but we only got like a minute left. So why don't we go ahead and take a break? We're here with Tom Douglas, Hall of Fame songwriter, And we're going to be back in just a few minutes on the Music Row Show. Back to the Music Row Show. You know that song. That song's Little Rock. That was a big hit for Colin Ray.
And we had Colin coming in here. He played it for us.
So, yeah, check out our podcast on that episode about a year or so ago. And he did a great version of that song. But we are here with the co-writer of that song, Hall of Fame songwriter Tom Douglas. And I was reading something you said I don't know how long ago, about a year or so ago, you were talking about Love's the Only House, which was a song that Martina McBride did. And you were talking about how the structure of that song is very similar to like the kind of stuff that Springsteen does in terms of structure.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that? And how does that differ from other stuff around
well,
here?
Well, you know, I mean, there are many Springsteen and Dylan songs and, you know, Tom Petty songs that where the chorus is just, it's really one line that you just repeat.
Like Free Fallin'.
Free Fallin'.
Yeah.
Of course, now I can't think of an example.
But Pink Cadillac.
Yeah, where it's the same line over and over. And the structure of that song is like this as well. Little Rock, Love's the Only House, which is it's just vignettes. You know, the first scene is the singer literally working in a grocery store. Somebody comes through, you know, who's disheveled, their life's falling apart, you know, and the singer says, you know, love's the only house big enough for all the pain in the world, love's the only house. And then the next vignette is, you know, you see an old lover, you mm-hmm. know, but you're a lover that is, you know, kind of, you know, thrown you by the wayside. And then over time, you know, you get your life together and, you know, the answer to your life's problems is love's the only house. And
yeah.
then, you know, so it's
little scenes,
little scenes all tied together by the same, by the same line, I did this same thing with Steve Seskin and Grown Men Don't Cry. I don't know why they say grown men don't cry. Don't know why they say grown men don't cry. It's the same thing.
That's the chorus.
That's
yeah.
the chorus. So, sometimes that works, you know.
Yeah.
I guess it just depends on the song. But I like those songs because it enables you to get really a little more lyric in the verse.
It's like each verse is a self-contained story.
Yeah, right.
As opposed to a big story that goes over
yes,
the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. One of the neat things about prepping for you this week has been just all of the little sentences that are out there on the web that I'm like, okay, I want to know more about what that means and what does that mean. And there was one place where you said writing a song is hard, it's painful, but writing a song down is easy.
Yeah.
So help me with that one.
Well, and again, I think Alan Shamblin said that. So I'm.
But he's not here.
He's not here.
I don't think I've had an original thought since about 1984. But I do know a good idea when I hear it. I think what you want to do, I think, in the writing, in the process, is you want to experience the song so vividly in your mind, either somewhere during the creative process, that you know the car that the protagonist is driving. You know what kind of coffee is spilled on the floorboard. You know what clothes they're wearing. You know where they've lived. You know what their favorite song is. Whether or not any of that ever gets into the song or not, I just think you have to know the people in the song. You have to know the places so intimately, and you kind of have to experience that in your mind. And so once you know that, then really you're writing something down that you've already experienced.
Okay.
So otherwise, if you're if you really don't know all those details, then the song, believe me, I know I've written 1,400 songs, they can sound awfully contrived. And I just think there's a legitimacy to an honesty to the song. If you've experienced it in your mind, then you're literally just writing it down.
You know the backstory.
Yeah. You got to have the backstory. If I said the three of us are going to write a song about, your favorite birthday.
Okay.
It would be whatever birthday comes into your mind, you would tell us about that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the song would really just kind of reveal itself on the page. Once we start writing some of those facts down and the antidotes and this and that, then, the song's there. It's waiting to be revealed.
Okay. I like that.
Wow.
I guess similar to who was it, the famous sculptor that said that the sculpture's already in there. He's just chipping away the extra rock.
Michelangelo.
Michelangelo. That guy.
Yeah, that guy.
Michael who?
I don't know. Right. I think he's got a pizza parlor.
He's
now
playing at Tootsie's with Stephen Sondheim on Broadway. Hey, stick around. We got lots more with Tom Douglas. You're listening to the Music Row Show. We're going to be right back.
They say you can't go home again. I just had to come back one last time. Ma'am, I know you don't know me from Adam, but these handprints on the front steps, they're mine.
Yeah.
And up those stairs.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's such a great song. That's The House That Built Me. And, of course, Miranda Lambert's version. That was ACM and CMA Song of the Year. And we're here with Tom Douglas, who co-wrote that with
Alan
Shamblin. Yeah, that's a great song.
Thank you.
We mentioned in the last break all the little snippets of things that you've said that are floating out there on the web. one of the ones that I wanted to ask you about is you said that the more personal language you use, the more universal a song becomes, which almost sounds like it would be contradictory.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, let's say everybody wants to write the ultimate love song.
Right.
And so you would think that it needs to be as general as possible to appeal to as many people as possible.
Right.
I mean, and of course, I'm not saying this is right. I'm just saying this is my opinion. But I think the more specific the story is, great detail, a very small story. When you tell small stories, I think they have a chance to become big. I just think it's very tough to tell a big story,
right?
And have it become bigger. So it's, there are a million examples that would contradict what I just said, but for me, it's like I have to tell very small stories, and I have to, I have to understand. I really have to have experienced the story either vicariously or literally for me to be able to, really adequately, tell the tale.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well, and you referenced this earlier, your Austin songwriting organization. Early on, while you were still doing the commercial real estate, you started getting involved with the local songwriting organization there in Texas. How did that help you, and do you recommend that for writers around the country who are getting started local? Or what are the benefits of having that organization around them?
Well, I mean, songwriters, what we desperately need is we need someone, you do have to have someone to listen. We do have to have feedback, even though I said a little earlier that you got to kind of detach yourself from that as quickly as possible. But at some point during the process, you need to get feedback. And that's what the NSAI, the Nashville Songwriters Association International, does. The only thing that I tell people that they must join is the NSAI. And it's because it has a structure and a network, throughout the country, maybe the world, where they've got all these, you know, satellite NSAI groups in Dallas and New York and L.A. and everywhere, you know, where you can get together with like-minded people that are, you know, at your same level, you know, trying to do what you're trying to do, and you can get some honest feedback. So I joined, you know, songwriter associations, and they were all kind of, you know, forerunners of the NSAI. I joined them in Atlanta, in Nashville, in Dallas, in Austin, anywhere I was. I tried to find like-minded people.
Sure.
Just to get some feedback.
Yeah.
So, you know, I highly, you know, commend the NSAI.
Well, we've just got a couple of minutes left, but just kind of looking at the business of all the different changes, and something you mentioned in your acceptance speech for when you were inducted into the Hall of Fame, which I recommend everybody go look up on the web.
It's
a great speech. It really is. But you said, don't sweat it. If the art is good, we're all going to get paid in terms of, you know, everything that's going on with songwriter royalties and everything. What did you mean by that?
Well, you know, I mean, songwriters are in a unique position. And I think it takes an amazing amount of self-discipline to do what we do. It's so hard to do what we do. People that don't do it, you know, I'm not looking for a pat on the back, but it's incredibly hard. It's hard to, you know, to get your thoughts down on paper. And so really that's about the only thing we can focus on. I know that CD sales are down and now iTunes sales are down and everybody's finding their music through streaming.
Right.
I get all that. But there's nothing really that we can do about that. We can join the NSAI and help lobby with them to Congress. And I think some of that, some of those changes are happening, but again, it takes our eye off the ball.
Okay.
It's hard enough to do what we do. Our only responsibility is to, you know, is to be true to ourselves and then try to tell a story, write a song, you know, that's going to give the listener a chance to apply his own life story, you know, as an overlay over our story. The reason why people like The House That Built Me is not
they see themselves in it.
It's not the song.
Yeah.
It is Miranda, but it's their story. You know,
right.
It's their house. It's their childhood. That's where you get traction if the listener can find themselves in your song. That's our responsibility.
That's awesome.
There you go.
Thank
you. I feel responsible.
I do. You are responsible for so much. Oh, thank you so much for joining us, Tom. We really love it that you're here. We hope that someday you'll come back and sit through another hour with us. We've got another great hour of the show coming up.
We have John Barry coming in. He's peeking through the window right now.
Look at that. That's him right there. John Barry's going to be joining us, so don't go away. Come back in just a few minutes on the Music Row Show. Strong heart.